Welcome to China Manufacturing Decoded from Sofeast, the podcast where we take you through some of the major topics facing importers and manufacturers in China today. Hello, welcome along to episode 18 of the podcast. This is part 6 of our mini-series about vetting Chinese suppliers. Following on from the last episode where we discussed factory audits, we're talking about social compliance audits today. These audits don't look into your supplier's technical ability, rather they look into whether they're abiding by the law, whether they are following good health and safety practices for staff, and whether they're engaging in shady business practices which are going to get you or your brand into trouble down the line. Let's hear what Renault's got to say about them.
Hi Renault, how's it going?
Hey Adrian. Yeah, good. How about you?
Yeah, fine, thank you. Today's topic, as you know, is talking about on-site social compliance audits. So we're into part 6 of the China Supplying Vetting mini-series that we're doing on the podcast. And previously, we've spoken about the vetting that you can do from the office. We've also spoken about when you do an on-site visit and make some determinations using your own eyes and ears when you're up with a potential supplier. We've started speaking about audits as well, and social compliance audits are one of the audits that are important for importers to think about conducting. So can you kick it off by just explaining what a social compliance audit is, please?
Sure. Basically, it is, you know, going to the factory and looking at certain things. Typically talking to people a lot and trying to see how the stuff is treated and looking at certain records, usually paper or IT records, right? It's not really about physical things like a process audit, a quality audit. This is much more about the human side, let's say, of a manufacturing business. So there's certain things, the very, very big things that no buyer wants to be associated with. They don't want to buy products that are made or, you know, in part or fully made in a facility, for example, where children are working. I mean, this is just something that can explode in their face and really tarnish their brand. You might still remember the photos of the Pakistani kids suing Nike soccer balls. And that was what, 10, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, maybe 20 years ago. People still remember it, you know, and Nike really went above and beyond what, you know, what other buyers do to really make sure it doesn't happen again. So no kids working. Okay. So this is typically not a problem in communist countries like China or Vietnam. It's very little of a problem. It's much more of a problem in some other countries where traditionally a lot of kids are working, right? So that's the first very big one. The second very big one is forced labor. So, I mean, these days there's a lot of talk about what happens to the Uyghur minority in China, you know, in, all the way in the west of China, and how they're treated and whether they're really like provided jobs and training, as the Chinese government says, or if they are mistreated and forced to work for very little pay in farms and factories, as a lot of other people say. And maybe it's somewhere between the two. I haven't been there, so I can't really say. And then you have, you know, let's say Tommy Hilfiger maybe buys some cotton that is managed through Esquel, the very big fabric and textile making company. And, you know, and the cotton comes from Xinjiang. And then, you know, you have these kinds of brands that, and a lot of others. I mean, there's so many others, pretty much every one of them, I guess, in the fashion brands are hit with that. I mean, people don't want to be associated with this kind of behavior, this kind of scandal, right? So forced labor is a very, very big one. And you can include a lot of things. Generally, under forced labor, a lot of other things would be associated, such as maybe the workers come and they have to provide a deposit for their safety shoes, or the workers arrive, they start to work, and their ID cards are taken, you know, confiscated, one might say. And when they make a mistake, there's a penalty, you know, deducted from their salary, and so on and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of things that go into this, you know, and some people would even put discrimination in there. There's a lot of things. Another one is health and safety. Also, nobody wants to work with a factory that that has accidents, work accidents, severe work accidents every month, or even every year. I mean, usually they don't know about it, right? But when you go there and you see some really dangerous working conditions, you have to say, wow, right? So the brands are very often, they're insulated from this, because the last steps that are done by their direct suppliers tend to be the finishing, you know, the assembly, the packing. That's usually not very risky. That's fine. However, as you go up the supply chain and you go into, for example, metal machining and die casting, or you go up, let's say it's in textile, so many problems for textile companies when it comes to social compliance.
Right.
It's really bad. So when you go up the supply chain, then you see the dyeing mills and all the bad stuff they release into the environment. That's not really health and safety. Well, you could say it's the health of the people living in the community. And in some cases, it is the health of the workers. There's a lot of fumes and things like that in the air. So health and safety, very often horrible in a lot of developing countries. And hey, remember in Europe, in the US, in Canada, 100 years ago, it was maybe even worse, right? So it's really a matter of people becoming aware of their, how much a life is worth, basically, and sort of thinking, would I want my kids to work here, and all these kind of things. This is a process that takes time. It takes time. Now, there's a lot of really horrible factories when it comes to that in China, for example, and in India and in some other countries. However, it's not a fatality. It's something. It's not a It's not something that cannot be avoided. When you look at the multinational companies that have a strong policy about that, it's just the same in their China operations. They're very careful with safety, you know, especially in sectors like oil and gas, for example, automotive. I mean, they're very careful. They apply the same standards worldwide. So does it cost a little bit more? In the end of the day, I'm not sure, because when you have an accident, someone goes to the hospital, you know, you have a problem. Now you have a worker, you have to keep paying him who's not working. Maybe it scares the others. They work slower. Maybe you cannot hire people in around you. I mean, I remember we were doing some consulting in close to Kaizhou 4 or 5 years ago, and the factory really had trouble recruiting. And then we started to talk to the HR staff and to talk to the employees, and they were like, yeah, well, you know, this place really has a bad image in the community around. Nobody wants to come and work here. Oh well, yeah, maybe there's a reason.
Surprise.
Yes. Yeah. And when you have a death, well, you know, in China, there's sort of a price for that. You pay 1 or 1.5 million RMB to the family. Well, that's, you know, maybe $200,000 US dollar. Plus you know, all the risks around that. If someone high up in the government hears about that, you might be in trouble, especially if he's the second one this year, you know, and, and same thing if there's a suicide or something like that. So health and safety is is a big one. So there's a few themes like this that are really big. Then there are some other themes that are in the standards that are considered important and that are, that might be given too much importance. So for example, the number of labor hours and rest days and so on. Of course, nobody wants to work with, you know, a sweatshop where people are working 14 hours a day, you know, sometimes 7 days a week and so on. Right, right. Of course, that's bad. But the situation there is a little bit complex, and that's something that consumers might not really understand. But in a country like China, the workers actually want to work harder, earn more, so that they don't have to live this migrant worker's life for 30 years. They want to live it for 5, 10, maybe 15 years, and then go back, you know, and then like they have kids, but the kids stay with the grandparents in their hometown, and they want to save enough money to quit that job, go back to the hometown, maybe live, you know, buy a little plot of land, maybe build a house there, which would be their house, and or maybe, you know, maybe also open their little business, and just have a an easy life after that. So that, that's sort of the mentality of a lot of workers, especially the migrant workers.
And at the same time, they're actually providing for the elderly folks and the kids who are back in the hometown. They're yeah. completely relying on them and their education and everything else. But this is funny that you mentioned this, because this is one of the things that in the Western media, I think people get really sort of torn up about. And, you know, there's phrases like the grueling hours that the staff are forced to work and all of this sort of thing. But I think, you know, in my experience, a lot of the workers, they want to work extra hours. They want to do overtime and earn more money. For exactly the reasons that you've said. So yeah, that's definitely a common misconception, isn't it?
Right. I mean, people coming from Sichuan, they don't want to eat Guangdong food for more than 10 years, right? They don't want to stay here longer, save less money every year, you know, and yeah, just stay longer. No, they want to go back fast. Mm. So if the workers want it, if obviously the employers don't mind, you know, why is this a problem? Because every standard, every company has to say we comply with the laws of the countries where we operate, and we make sure that our suppliers comply with the laws where we operate. And in China, it's 40 hours a week, with up to 36 hours of overtime per month. So it's really, you know, it's not that much. And there's got to be some rest days. I can't remember exactly. It's like at least one rest day every 7 days, something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
And so what does the stupid importer do? They tell their suppliers, we'll send an auditor, you know, up to this standard. And it's like, it's not our fault, it's the standard, you know. And then the others come there and they say, well, you know, Chinese labor Chinese labor laws say this, and it's tougher than the standard, so I have to follow that. And hey, you guys don't pass because you are really not compliant, you know. And then what does that force the supplier to do? Because the supplier is not going to change the way they're doing business because everybody around them does the same. It's like, you know, 97% of the factories do that, and their workers want that. So they only have one alternative, is to lie, is to prepare the fake book, you know, that records the start time and end time, and to the fake payroll and all these kind of things. And basically the suppliers are trained to lie. I mean, it's not like it's not something they would ever do, but it's even worse. It's much worse than quality audits, where they would maybe put some fake numbers on a graph on a wall just to show it kind of looks nice and so on, and manufacture some records to say, yeah, we have records, but it's much, much worse. I mean, it's just in an industry-wide practice that is here to stay. And some of these suppliers, they have so many different standards falling onto them, it makes their life really complicated. I mean, some of them, they have to comply with Walmart, with Disney, with SIDEX, with whatever else, you know, and they have 8 or 9 different kinds of books, you know, sort of fake records, basically.
Mm.
And either they prepare that internally or very often with consultants. Often consultants who used to be auditors, so they really know the games, let's say. And it's so much waste, you know, so much effort put into lying and producing fake proofs where they should be working on improvements. So anyway, the working hours is one that I think is a bit ridiculous. It's given too much importance. If they want it, you know, if the labor wants it, you know, open your eyes, basically. So that's what a dumb buyer would tend to do. And sometimes they don't have a choice. Is there a channel? Is there a distribution channels? If they sell into, for example, a certain retailer that says, we have our standard, here's the way, and we work with such and such auditing company, and they will have to approve the factory. Well, you don't really have a choice. But you're not, you know, it might be a very dumb kind of practice that you have to jump through. The smarter importer will think of where to focus his efforts. You know, if at least people are not going to get killed working in the factory, and there's no kids, and nobody is treated badly, and they improve year over year, I should be very happy. You know, that's what some companies are thinking, and I really encourage that. But all the other ones, like a bunch of sheep, they all do the same, and so there's different standards. You know, there's BSCI, and then there's for toys, ICTI, which is a bit tougher. Then there's SIDEX, and so on and so forth. Some factories manage to be certified to SA 8000, which is kind of tough, but that's a small minority. But yeah, all the other ones are really led by buyer groups. There's RAP also, especially in apparel. I mean, there's been a flurry of standards that have appeared, and it's been very, very good business for the large testing labs, because they love doing this kind of auditing and charging, you know, charging a high price for that.
Mm.
And usually it's paid by the supplier, and the supplier is told, look, you want to work with us, you have to pass the audit. You have to have at least, let's say, a B. If you have a C or a D, you know, that's not going to work. And here's the list of auditing companies. You pick one, they're all basically the same price. You do it and we get the results. That's the way it works very often. So it's very good business for the auditing testing companies. And by the way, sometimes it's also a profit center for the buyers, which is really nuts when you think about it. But they will negotiate with a lab, and they will say, well, you charge $1,000 to the supplier, and then your real price is $500. The other $500, you credit it to us, okay? You give it back to us. and maybe we'll give you some lab testing and things like that. And, you know, it's credited on against our purchases of lab tests and inspections and things like that, things that we really have to pay ourselves. But this is a really dirty kind of approach, I think. Very dirty kind of approach. So it's the easy way of saying, you know, 75% of the factories that work with us have had at least a B grade. And, oh, that's great. You know, they tend to be improving over time. Here are the numbers. But when you know the realities of it, it's improving because in a country like China or Vietnam, you know, where it's getting harder and harder to get good staff, factories just sort of, you know, have to improve over time just to attract them. So more often they will have maybe some air-conditioned areas, maybe a basketball court, maybe whatever, better dormitories, you know, whatever makes sense for the employees. And also they will try to avoid maybe working all the staff through the night just because there's an urgent order. You know, these kinds of practices will tend to disappear over time. I hope so. But yeah, I believe the market forces themselves are changing all this. And that's a good thing. And all this auditing, all these social compliance audits are just are not helping. They're just capturing these trends in the market and making the brands look good and basically covering their asses. That's what it is. That's what it is. And it's sort of a tax on the manufacturers. You know, I say tax, I could say something stronger. I don't think it's ethical sometimes. It's funny because many of these programs are called ethical sourcing. But then in the implementation, I think that's very unethical. So, I'm not very positive on these things. And when you add to that the fact that social compliance auditors, not all of them, but a good portion of them are quite dirty, you know, they take a lot of bribes. It's just everybody knows that in the industry because there's too much money at stake. And because they are auditing to a standard that they know the manufacturer cannot comply with, right? And the manufacturer knows they know, and so it's like, you know, what can we do to pass the audit? And then they show a number, you know, or they have some more more elaborate ways to extract money. But there's a lot of bribes there. So as a buyer, basically you're teaching your suppliers you're pushing them to lie, to produce fake recalls and so on, to cheat. Mm. And on top of that, you send people to them who are going to extract money, or, you know, you're going to create some corruption in your supply chain, basically, which is crazy. Which is really crazy, right? And then they call that ethical sourcing.
Yeah, it's a bit of a misnomer, isn't it? I suppose that the rigid nature of standards doesn't really help in this respect, because, you know, like you were talking about the overtime situation, which actually anybody familiar with China will know that there's a big difference between employees working quite a lot of overtime by Western standards and forced labor. But a little bit of finesse is required here, because although definitely this makes social compliance audits open to abuse, because you're going to audit a supplier who cannot comply with, for example, the overtime stipulations in the standard. But on the other hand, there are some good points as well, because as an importer, if you're trying to at least do the best you can to assure that your supply chain is at least as free from abuse as it can be, or as perhaps it's possible for you to know if you're, say, sitting in the US and you're trying to source from a new supplier and you want to get a handle on, you know, what they're doing, and are they actually doing something that's really, really not okay? They've still got a role to play in that respect, right?
Yeah. So the standards, as you say, yes, they are kind of rigid. And again, it comes back to a purchasing manager or a COO saying, look, or maybe the company producing a corporate social responsibility report or something every year. Mm. And they need to have some statistics, you know, and if they can say, yeah, we work with these companies and we, you know, that blah, 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 and you have to be BSCI certified or something like this, it does sound good. And if they say X percent of them are compliant to that X percent level and so on, that's great. So you need to have a rigid scale in this case, right? Otherwise, you can't really compare and year over year say that you improve and everything. So I understand why they want these kind of things, but yes, it doesn't really help on the ground. Now, social compliance auditing comes in many flavors. On the one hand, you can tell your suppliers, this is a must. If you don't pass, you know, if you don't get at least that grade, we cannot do business with you. Well, that comes with a lot of pressure, right? And you are going to train your suppliers to cheat, just to cover your ass, basically. If you say, we're going to audit you just to understand the reality of it, and then we will re-audit you, you know, every 1 year, every 2 years, or maybe every 6 months, if it's very bad, and we will see if you improve. Well, that already is much better, right? There's no short-term pressure. It's okay, we want to know the reality, and then we want to see if you improve. So the incentive is no longer there to hide. Now, of course, if they've been trained by a lot of other buyers, they will still try to give you a rosy picture of the situation, of course. I mean, you can't, you know, they cannot unlearn easily what they've learned for many years. But it's a much smarter approach. And then if you're a small buyer, and this is really, really important to you, you just say, well, you know, we're just going to send an auditor just to know the situation, and that's it. You know, it's going to be just one criterion in our decision, and you know, we'll know better about your company, right? And sometimes you find that, you know, maybe the supplier is very, very small, doesn't even have a labor contract with the staff, doesn't have any safety precautions, that doesn't, you know, it's like level zero. At least you know that, you know, yeah, something bad could happen here because they don't have any systems. They don't have any way of actually preventing bad stuff from happening. But like, on the other hand, you're working with a white page and you could help them get better over time if they cooperate, right? So it goes both ways. Good to have the information, but I would say not good to put a lot of pressure and make it conditional in a certain grade on a standard that they can't really satisfy, because you're just creating corruption in your supply chain, basically.
That's very, very helpful information, because I guess a lot of importers out there would be thinking, okay, I've got to do a social compliance audit. I know the standard, so I'm going to now be waiting for this report to come back and see all of these tick boxes, and that's all very well. But as you've rightly pointed out, that's perhaps quite a sort of blunt way to do it, and a little bit more thought and finesse might be needed to really be able to get, would it be fair to say, correct results?
An accurate picture of the situation. I mean, if you don't want to play games, that's what you want as the buyer. And then you decide what to do about it. based on other criteria and also obviously based on the level of cooperation from the supplier.
Excellent. Okay. So yeah, there you have it about social compliance audits. That's brilliant. Thanks for filling us in on that, Renaud. That's great.
Great. All right. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, don't forget to like and share, and you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all other places that you get your podcasts from. See you next time.